The following audio is included in the Worldwide Church of God Library Collection. Please visit wwcg-library.com and explore the incredible truths that answer the mysteries of life.
So his coming, or announcing about taking the offering reminds me of a couple of incidents that I've heard of, how individuals were determining what they should give in an offering. He and I both went to Texas A&M, and I heard it, there were a couple of Texas Aggies trying to determine how much they should give for an offering in church. One was a Catholic Aggie, and the other was a Jewish Aggie. Catholic Aggie said, it's simple, I just draw a circle on the ground, I throw up all the money I have. When it comes back down, all that lands in the circle belongs to God, and I keep the rest. It doesn't take any difficulty on my part. So after the Catholic Aggie had told his method, he asked the Jewish Aggie, well, how do you determine what you give to God? He said, it's very simple. He said, I take all the money I have, I throw it up in the air. God knows what is his, and he keeps it. All the rest of it falls back down, and I keep that. No trouble whatsoever. But then there was the little boy who was going to church, and his father gave him two coins, a dime and a quarter. Father said to the little boy, and I said, you give one of them at the offering and you can keep the other one. And it is up to you as to which one you give. And you can choose whichever one you want to give at the offering. So Daddy stayed home and watched the Sunday morning movie, and they sent the little boy off to church. When the boy came back, Dad was sitting watching NFL football. And he asked the boy, well, what did you do? Which one did you give? And the little boy said, well, as they were taking up the offering, I started to give the quarter. But just as I was about to drop it in the offering basket, I heard the minister say that God loves a cheerful giver. And he said, I thought I'd be more cheerful if I gave the dime than if I gave the quarter, so I just gave the dime. I don't know if those really happened or not, but I thought it humorous about how you determine what you give for an offering, because we all have different methods, I suppose. Well, this is the first year for my wife, Julie, and our two sons, Michael and David, to be in Wisconsin Dells. Actually, this is the eighth year in a row that we've been able to go to a different feast site, because of being in various church areas, and those church areas being assigned to different festival sites by moving the boundaries. In 1971, we went to Big Sandy from Phoenix, Arizona. And in 1972, they said, well, you can go to either Big Sandy or Squaw Valley. We hadn't been to Squaw Valley since 64, so we decided to go to Squaw Valley. And then in 1973, they started the festival site in Tucson, so we went to Tucson from Phoenix. Then we were transferred to Charlotte, North Carolina. In 74, we went to Jekyll Island. Then 75 to Roanoke, Virginia. In 76 to Hampton, Virginia, from Charlotte also. We just moved to Indianapolis, but still went on to Hampton to be with Charlotte. Then last year, we went to the Ozarks, the first and only time. Then this year, to Wisconsin Dells. So I think moving around to different feast sites helps you to enjoy it a little bit. That's the big part, but it does add a little bit to see different festival sites. In one sense, coming to Wisconsin Dells, though it's not Milwaukee, is like coming home, because this is where it all started for me back in 1961. I was an undergraduate ministerial assistant in Milwaukee. Milwaukee was Chicago, but Mr. Blackwell had several areas, and Milwaukee was part of it. And the first sermonette I ever gave was in Milwaukee, probably from March or April of 1961. The first time I ever led songs in church service was in Milwaukee. And the first Bible study I ever conducted was in Milwaukee. So there are some fond memories of Milwaukee and the North Country, God's country, they say, in Wisconsin for me, because that's where I started in the ministerial assistant job. I was working with Mr. Dean Blackwell, Mr. Hal Baird, and Mr. John Ball, and they're all very, very different. I was assisting all three of them. I just had to remember who I was visiting with and whose car I was driving at the time, knowing how to shift gears and do different things like that. But it was very interesting and many, many fond memories of Milwaukee, Chicago, and other areas. I had a reason for saying that I knew he would only leave me not so much time, because the first time I ever gave a sermon at was in Milwaukee, March or April of 61. I was so nervous and so scared that had he introduced me and I gotten up to speak immediately, I don't think I would have made it, because my knees were rattling and shaking so badly, and my stomach was turning so badly that I really couldn't have opened my mouth and said very much. But for some reason, Mr. Blackwell went on for about 10 or 15 minutes introducing me. Now, for him to talk 10 or 15 minutes is not strange at all, but for him to introduce me for 10 or 15 minutes, I did think a little strange, but I was really grateful to God that he did, because I couldn't have gotten up and spoken the first minute. But I had calmed down enough that at least I could get up and talk a little bit. I don't remember what I said, but I know I was very, very shaken up. But those were the good old days. Back in 1961, Mr. Blackwell had Chicago. On Friday night he had Chicago from 7:30 to, excuse me, Friday night he had Milwaukee from church services from 7:30 to 9. Stick around for an hour or so and leave about 11, get home to Chicago at 1 a.m. He lived out in Joliet. Then we had Chicago in the morning from 10 to 12. Bloomington, Illinois from, 2:30, 4:30, or 3:30 to 5:30. And then, because there wasn't anywhere else to go, we had Spokesman's Club Saturday night in Bloomington. Leave there about 11 o'clock, get home at 1 a.m. And then, just a little extracurricular activity, he also had South Bend, Indiana, Sunday afternoon for a Bible study at that time, later turned into a church service. Of course, by that time, we'd listened to his sermons four times on the weekends, his Texas Aggie jokes four times on the weekends. And he couldn't understand why we were getting sleepy and tired and wanted to go to sleep when he was ready to go. But come Sunday afternoon, we were all dragging our tracks out very, very badly. But they were very memorable days, and I do hold some fond spots in my heart for this area because of those days and those memories. Well, last year at the Ozarks, I spoke first, and so I grabbed the first sermon I want to do. I could pick and choose what I wanted to. This year, speaking last, Mr. Blackwell has already chosen for him. He got to speak on the meaning of the day this afternoon. But I had to wait until the last time to see if they had gotten my subject. So far, none of them took it completely and totally, so give what I chose to give. Millard Fillmore became president of the United States, yet Millard Fillmore was not born to that office. I don't think he came from a rich family, but I don't think he was poverty-stricken either. As a youth, Millard Fillmore had a job operating a carding machine in garment manufacturing or in the fabric manufacturing. He was a man of modest means, I suppose a little bit self-conscious. Sometime in his life, while he was working at this job at the carding machine, a young lady moved into the town where he was living. She was a school teacher. Apparently, she must have been fairly attractive, because Millard Fillmore flipped his cookie, to use modern jargon, over this young school teacher. She was the prettiest thing that he had ever seen. And those curls in her hair just captivated him. He couldn't keep his eyes off her because she was so pretty, so attractive, so feminine. And those curls in her hair, he just had never seen the like of it. But the school teacher was out of Millard's class. She was educated, attractive, dignified, and cultured. And he just had a job operating a carding machine and hadn't gotten all that much education yet. But Millard Fillmore set his head together. He wanted to marry her. And even though she was out of his class, that didn't stop him. Now, he didn't go up and bowl her over and say, I'm going to marry you anyway right now. He set himself according to a plan to make sure that he would be qualified to marry her. During the jumps or breaks in the carding machine, he began to study the dictionary. Now, you might think that's a very, very dull and boring job, reading and studying the dictionary, but not so. Because when you study words, you're studying history. You're studying people. You're studying geography. You're studying the ebb and flow of people. Because words come from the use that people give them. And it activates the mind. It invigorates the mind. It educates you. I don't know what else he went on to do, but he went on ultimately to go to law school, had enough money that finally he was able to marry his beloved schoolmarm. She was no longer out of his class. Maybe he was above her in class in one sense, though we're equal with man and woman. But he set himself to marry the woman. And he set himself to be able to provide for her and to take unto himself a lovely wife. He went on ultimately to rise to become the President of the United States of America. Now, Millard Fillmore's example illustrates a point for the youth of God's church today, and maybe for those of us who are members of the church also. His example illustrates a very important point. Millard Fillmore believed in improving yourself today in order to ensure a better future tomorrow. The future didn't hold all that much for him, but he worked on himself and he improved himself in order to make sure that his future tomorrow would be good. That's a very, very important point for the youth of God's church. This is stated in different words in Proverbs 29, verse 18, where Solomon and other individuals who have written down Proverbs that I assume Solomon collected, edited, put into a book, and God has allowed to be preserved for us today. Principles which men came to as they looked around at life that are concise principles, that are living principles. Much more lively and wise than the Proverbs of the Eastern countries. But in Proverbs 29, verse 18, it says, where there is no vision, the people perish. The margin says, they're made naked. That is, they come to tattered rags sometimes. There's not much that life holds for them because of that lack of vision. I would say because there is no vision at times in young people, the future doesn't hold all that much for them. They don't look to the future. They don't plan for the future. They don't prepare for the future. And quite often, the future is not very kind to young people. Because of the lack of vision, shall we say, short-sightedness on their part and on the part of their parents. Because vision is the ability to see up ahead in the future, to see what's in front of you, what the future holds. Daniel 11 gives the longest running prophecy, the chronicling of history in advance. And when you read that and understand that, you can mold yourself to life accordingly, knowing what the future holds, because you have the vision. It has been given to you. You know the ultimate outcome of events. You don't know all the details, but you know the ultimate outcome of those events. And by being able to see up ahead into the future, you can sidestep a lot of the problems. You can ensure that when the future arrives, as far as you're concerned, with your efforts, God's blessing, the future can be very kind to you. When we apply vision, what do we see when we look up ahead? front of us in the road. You as you, what do you see? Do you see anything at all when you look into the future? Well, you've heard sermons here at the Beast. There's coming a time of world trouble such as never has been nor ever will be. A time of trouble that if God did not intervene, and you youth need to be thankful that God will intervene, there would not be one human being left alive on the face of this earth. That's how much God is concerned for you as a youth. There's coming a time of trouble such as never has been, and that's not just a prophetical statement. If you read about the neutron bomb that our president now has authorized to go ahead and build some of the parts to the device, or the component portions of it that can kill people but not destroy the buildings, there is coming a time that is pretty bad. That's just a foregone conclusion. But as we saw also, it is a time of national captivity for modern-day Israel, which is a pretty bad thing to contemplate. Nobody likes to think about their beloved country going into captivity, especially if you're a youth looking forward to an enjoyable future. And it isn't very wonderful to contemplate thinking that your beloved country is going to go into national captivity. But we see on beyond that, and the vision God has given us, the kingdom of God, the millennial kingdom of God, and ultimately the family of God, where human beings will be born into God's family. I hope you as youth realize that we preach the good news of God's kingdom. Yes, we include the bad news today, but we preach the good news of the kingdom of God. We preach the good news of a better world than the one in which we live today. When we applied vision years ago, we only saw 1972, which was the end of all, not the downfall of this nation and the conclusion of God's work, but quite often it was the end of all things. There was a little bit of short-sightedness involved. And because it was, to all intents and purposes, the end of all things, it meant that there wasn't all that much of a need for effort to be expended in preparing for the future. And I've seen a lot of kids ruin their lives because they thought the future held nothing. And they were using great short-sightedness. A lot of individuals in the church, youth, have blamed the church for there being nothing, for their not having the things today in life that they would like to have. They blame 1972, but 1972 was not the cause of their not having anything today. Because there are other youth in the church who have gone through the difficulties, distresses, and troubles. But they held on to hope, and they planned, and they worked, and they have something of worth and value today. I've seen youth in the church seethe in hostility over the Sabbath because they hated and despised the Sabbath because it, for their way of thinking, inhibited them from having a good time. And all the while, 4 years of high school, they were seething in hostility toward the Sabbath. They weren't doing a crack-a-thicken thing about their own life as far as improving themselves. And 4 years later, when they got out of high school, they didn't have to keep the Sabbath because there was nobody there that made them. But they also didn't have a good job either because they didn't have the credentials to get a good job because they'd wasted those 4 years because they were mad at the Sabbath. And now that they were on their own and didn't have to keep the Sabbath, they also had to put up with not having a good job, and they didn't have the money that they wanted because they didn't have the credentials that they needed to get and hold a good job. Hatred of present religion can cause great difficulties in the future. It doesn't matter to you if you don't believe this is the truth. It matters as to what you're doing now to ensure the future. Maybe you'll come to believe this is the truth later. I don't really care whether you believe it's the truth. I do care if you're working on yourself to improve yourself and have a happy life in the future. I think God will take care of your coming to see whether or not it is the truth. when you see the Earth reeling out of its orbit, as it was described, I think you're going to think about, is there a God and is there a right philosophy? That'll probably take care of itself. But I've seen many, many Jews since the first time I walked into the church in Pasadena in the late 56, who sat there and seethed for the truth. And when they had their chance, they left. But they wasted their golden years of foundational opportunities because they hated the Sabbath. And then the stark reality of life itself hit them squarely in the face when they realized they didn't have the credentials to get an old good job. They were not improving themselves looking forward to the future. They were seething in hostility toward the truth while they wasted their chances. And I would call that stupidity. And I don't mean that maliciously toward the youth, but just factually, that is stupid. I want to point out a couple of points in the parable of the prodigal son, not in a caustic way, but in a factual way as to what happened. In Luke 15, verses 11 through 19. Luke 15, verses 11 through 19.
Some points about the parable of the prodigal son. A young individual who did not like his father's style of life, his father's philosophy, nor his father's home. In verse 11, a man had two sons. The younger said to his father, "Give me the portion of goods that belongs to me." Now the father did not say, "I'm not going to." He said, "There's the door. Here's the money. Take off." The father divided the son his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, took his journey to a far country, and there he wasted all that he had with riotous misery, because that many times is what you think life is made of, wine, lemon, and song. When he had spent all that he had, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and it began to be in want. He went and joined himself to a citizen of the country, and of course the man sent him out into the fields to feed swine. He would have filled his belly with the husk that the swine ate, and no man gave him anything. He realized that life was pretty tough at times, and there aren't all that many people sometimes that will lend a helping hand. Now it says when he came to himself, and I guess we all fit in that from time to time, that we have to come to ourselves. He said, "How many hired servants did my father have bread enough and spare, and I perish with hunger?" He said, "I'll arise and go to my father and say, 'I've sinned, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired servants.'" Look at a few of the points involved. One, the youth had a simmering hostile attitude toward his father's philosophy, his father's home, and his father's authority. Two, he thought that life would give him everything he wanted. And because his father had improved himself and had sufficient to give to him, he did start off with a nice little bounty in his hand. But that was because of his father's generosity, not of his own ability. Because he had not developed the character of working and providing it for himself, he wasted it. Because he thought there was wine, woman, and song. Next, he did not have a career. And since he didn't have a career, he was unskilled labor, he had to feed the hogs. You know, money dictates, and talent dictates. And when you are on your own, you realize that. Notice also that if it had not been for his father, he would have been sunk. He had to cast himself back on the generosity of his father. Were it not for his father, he would have become a slave, in the sense of enslaved to a low-paying job that was boring agony for the rest of his life. Now, when we look into the future and apply vision, we see some beautiful, glorious times after the troubles. There is a future. This day pictures that there is going to be a future for the vast majority of mankind who have thought there wasn't any reason. There is a future for you as a youth. There is a glorious, wonderful future. There is all the reason in the world to live and to enjoy life. There is all the reason in the world to prepare for a life. There is all the reason in the world to have hope. And I hope that you do not dissipate it. and wasted a golden opportunity in those formative years, and then find to his sad shame and chagrin that when you're old enough to be on your own, you can't afford to be on your own because you haven't prepared for it. You can shoot it all by wasting your chance to develop it. You don't have to pollute yourself to repent. I think sometimes we think you have to be like the prodigal son to learn what repentance is. Jesus never sinned, and yet when he was called good, he said, "Why call you me good? There's none good but God." He realized what he could have done. You don't have to pollute yourself to repent and learn what the good life is all about. Life is not really complicated. The principles and rules for a good life are very, very simple. And they're easy to apply once you get your head screwed on straight and start in the right direction. And I just want to impress several areas of life on you this morning, hopefully to inspire you and encourage you to prepare for the future. Because there is going to be a very wonderful future. And the degree to which you enjoy it will depend on the degree to which you prepare yourself for it now. For most of us as adults, we're over the hill. And we may develop some more. But for you, it is yet before you. And there's an awful lot of beauty and goodness to be enjoyed. And I hope you don't miss it. One area of life that is very important is that of education. Life is a learning process and a process of learning. That's not double talk. But life is a process of learning, and it is a learning process. And without education, in other words, if you're ignorant, stupid, it's not all that much fun. There are those people who can't read and write. They feel very inferior, very, very self-conscious. In Proverbs 24, verse 3, the writer also came to this conclusion concerning education and its involvement in life. Proverbs 24, verse 3, it says, "Through wisdom is a house built, and by understanding is it established. And by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with all precious and pleasant riches." I think you all of you would like to live in a fine home, have a good job, have a good-looking husband or a beautiful wife, good-looking, healthy children. If you say you don't, then I say you're crazy. But that may depend on your educational ability to secure unto yourself a job befitting those things. It talks about knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Knowledge is acquaintance with the facts. Understanding is knowing what they mean. And wisdom is the ability to put it all together and to make a good choice. And that's what life is all about, making those choices. You know, like throwing the money up in the air, letting God keep what he wants. Take your rest. Making a good choice. In the USA today, we have forced education. It is required that you go to school. It is not required that you learn anything.
But it is required that you go to school. Whether or not you learn anything is your business. And today you're seeing many, many articles about functional illiterates. I was discussing that with our sons the other day in a restaurant. I asked them if they knew what an illiterate person was. They didn't know what a functional illiterate person was. And we discussed the meaning of being a functional illiterate, grading on the curve, goofing off, just getting by. Nobody's going to make you study. Nobody is going to make you learn. You may turn out to be a functional illiterate. If you do, it is your fault. Because we have fantastic educational opportunities in the United States today. You have the right, you have the privilege, you have the honor of becoming educated. But it is to your shame and disgrace if you become a functional illiterate. And you read articles about why Johnny can't read. Well, part of it may be the system, but part of it is that Johnny doesn't take the time to make himself read either. There are other other distractions. It seems that youth go to school today for every reason under the sun other than to learn. In Hosea 4, verse 6, we have applied that spiritually to the people of Israel, that they're cut off for a lack of knowledge, spiritual knowledge. But let's apply that to you and me as an individual, physically, especially to you as youth. What will the future hold for you? You may be cut off for a lack of knowledge. There are individuals who cannot qualify for jobs because they don't have the credentials. Why don't they have the credentials? Partly because they never forced themselves to acquire the credentials. It was there for the asking, it was there for the taking, it was theirs. It was free and would have been gladly given to them. But they didn't exercise the effort to take it unto themselves. He says, my people are cut off for a lack of knowledge. Life is a learning process. You need knowledge, understanding, and wisdom to live a full, abundant, happy life. And many individuals settle for mediocrity because they wasted their chances for education. Even if you do not believe this is God's church, youth, I don't care. Even if you don't believe these holy days are God's wonderful plan for all of mankind, that doesn't make any difference. Even if you don't believe the Sabbath is the true day of worship, that doesn't make any difference. Don't waste your opportunities and seize at the Sabbath. And then graduate as a functional, illiterate, and waste your opportunities. If your father and mother believe in the Sabbath, fine. If you don't, okay. Shall we say, to use the language, put up with it for 4 years. Then you're on your own. You can do what you want to. But study and learn during those 4 years. Because when you're on your own, you are on your own. We applied a little bit of short-sightedness in prophesying 72. And many of the youth looked forward to the time when they were in national captivity. Not a very pleasant thought. But you know, again, I say, what difference does it make? Did you know there was a great servant of God who will have a fantastically high position in God's kingdom, who as a youth heard that he and his country were going into national captivity, but they didn't change their ways? And you know what? Daniel went into national captivity. But because Daniel had done something, all the while he was hearing that he was going into national captivity, Daniel rose to a tremendous position of prominence. You'll find this in Daniel 1, beginning in verse 1. Daniel 1, in verse 1. The story of the three Hebrew children is a tremendous lesson for the youth in God's church in these verses. In the third year of the rule of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And God gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. And of course, they were carried into the land of Babylon into national captivity. Now in verse 3, in captivity, the king spoke to Ashpenaz, master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and the king's children and of the princes. Look, youth of God's church, children in whom was no blemish. Now, I don't know exactly how old was Daniel at this time. Commentators say he was a youth. Let's say 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20. He wasn't an old man. He was a youth. Judah heard for many years. Judah, if you don't change your national way of life, you're going to be captivity. Daniel grew up under the cloud of national captivity. But Daniel did not waste his chances, even though he heard of national captivity. Children in whom was no blemish. Are good-looking youth always ignorant, vain, stubborn, and rebellious? Can good-looking, well-built, clear-eyed, clean-faced youth be intelligent, moral, and principled? Yes, they can. And if they are, they will enjoy life fantastically more than the others. Children in whom was no blemish. I assume Daniel was well-built and good-looking, but well-favored, skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science. There was a kid who went into national captivity, yet he was intelligent. He was in good health. He had something on the ball. Now, he wasn't, I don't think, sent into national captivity because he was a rebel and a brat, but he happened to be living in the wrong country. But that they would destroy his future. Such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace. There were social graces that they understood also, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. He was well-built, good-looking, intelligent, educated, and had social graces, and knew because of that he was chosen for further teaching. Those in bad health, those ignorant ones, didn't have a chance. One of our friends in Indianapolis, Michael Vogel, soccer coach at the Jewish Community Center, was a young man when Hitler dominated Europe. He was in one of the concentration camps. He still bears his tattoo. He was in good health. He was strong. He was able to work. Because of that, he was chosen to be one of the workers. It was his lot to unload his own people, and partly to help decide as to who was gassed and who was saved. There were other times when he almost lost his life, because he was intelligent, because he was quick-witted, and because he had a desire to live, he always escaped. He's alive today. He lives in prosperous America. He enjoys a reasonable good life, but he went through an awful captivity, unloading even his own people. He talks about it now. It hasn't ruined his life totally. Daniel's life was not ruined. He was young, he was educated, and he hadn't wasted his chances. You all have heard of Robert L. Kuhn, Bob as they call him. He holds a high position in God's work. He has a good education. As a teenager, a Jewish teenager in New York City, he heard this Protestant that we are looked upon by Jews, preacher, Herbert Armstrong or Ted Armstrong. He said he immediately knew it was the truth. But he was a Jew. And he was a traitor if he accepted this. But he said he knew it was the truth. Well, he didn't accept it, but he just put it on the shelf. Went ahead, finished his education, went to college, got a good education, got a doctor's degree in brain research, and because he exercised himself in that way, he was able to collaborate with Mr. Herbert Armstrong, because Bob Kuhn had shown him that there is a non-physical agent in the brain of man, as Mr. Armstrong was showing from the Bible, there was a spirit of man. He has collaborated with Mr. Herbert Armstrong in writing what Mr. Armstrong calls the greatest book since the Bible. But when he heard the truth as a youth, he didn't necessarily accept it. He just put it on the shelf, but he didn't pollute himself, he didn't degenerate himself, and he didn't waste his opportunities. He went ahead and prepared himself. God really began to work with him. There was something there to work with. Education is a foundation for the future. You have, as a youth, free time, no families, not as many obligations. You don't have to hold down a job. You have time to study chemistry, biology, geography, history, language, music, and other educational aspects. You have time to drink in and become educated. Don't waste those chances because you hate the Sabbath. Don't waste those chances because you can't date a neck on Friday night. What is the future worth? One Friday night of necking all night long? What a waste. Please don't waste your opportunities while you have the chance to become an educated, intelligent individual. You'll never regret it when you grow up. Another wonderful aspect of life is the physical aspect, physical development, the development of the flesh and blood soul, which we are and I have. What is life? You know, we preach that God is going to give us eternal life. We don't preach that we're going to exist forever. We preach the good news of the kingdom and family of God when we are going to live forever. A life that will never, ever end. A never-ending series of wonderful experiences of life, not existence. There is a difference between existing and living. What is life? Well, technically, it is the oxidizing of the blood. The breathing in, breathing out of air into the lungs, and of it oxidizing in the blood, and giving you that spark we call energy, but also is produced by the consumption of foods which we get from the soil. Good life, to a degree, depends upon good physical condition. There are a lot of people in God's church who have the Spirit of God who are very, very unhappy because they are in horrible physical condition. It is difficult for them to pray and study because they're in pain. It is difficult for them to work because they are physically suffering. My mother used to tell me that physical exercise doesn't profit you. Now, there's a verse in the Bible that appears to say that, but she misquoted it. And I heard that many, many times. Look at 1 Timothy 4 and verse 7. I want to impress this upon your mind. How many of you youth, if you're a young woman, want to marry a man who so sick and emaciated and weak that he cannot even lead you physically? How many of you young men want to marry a young lady who doesn't exactly look like a young lady and who's not able to give you healthy children and who doesn't have the energy to prepare food because she is suffering unbelievably from hypoglycemia or low blood sugar because her blood is in an awful condition? I don't think you really do. But it is becoming more and more common for people to have that disease, a bad condition of the blood because of not taking care of themselves and diet and exercise properly. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 7, Paul is telling the young evangelist Timothy, who may have been somewhat physically weak. This is not the biggest point in life at all, but it is a point. Paul was impressing upon Timothy's mind to be a faithful minister, to teach the truth, but he also put this point in. He said, refuse profane and old wives' fables, and exercise yourself rather under godliness. Now, being like God is the most important of all, because that is the goal of all of us, and it will profit far more Arnold Schwarzenegger's techniques. But he says, for bodily exercise profits little. Now, you can emphasize that. Ah, it's useless. For bodily exercise, doesn't profit anything in life. Forget it. Concentrate on the spiritual only. You know, there are people who cannot, in God's church, who cannot get down on their knees to pray on their knees because their knees are so stiff. They cannot bend the knee because their health is bad. You cannot separate the spiritual and the physical, really. They're tied in together. He has given a contrast becoming like God is the most important. But we've heard during this feast that we should glorify God in our bodies. Ill health does not glorify God. Sunken chested, hollow eyed, acne faced young people do not enjoy life. Fat, frustrated female youth in bad health do not enjoy life and don't enjoy looking forward to the future either.
Now, the Sabbath has not made them that way. The holy days have not made them that way. The good news of the kingdom of God has not made them that way. Improper diet and lack of exercise has. And only they can really do something about that. Paul said, bodily exercise profits for a little while. You exercise today, lay off for a few days, and you realize it's just a short while. But it does profit. It does profit. It is amazing to watch a, pardon the words, but dumpy, fat young girl growing up, feeling self-conscious, and finally she sees the light, begins to watch her diet, loses weight, gets a svelte figure. It changes her whole personality. I have asked them who have lost weight, do you feel different? Sure I do. It changes my whole outlook on life. What is life? It's physical. It's governed by God's Spirit and God's laws, but it is physical. And you as youth, don't waste the future by ruining your health today.
Blowing your mind with drugs. Did you know that through proper diet and exercise, you can sculpture your body in one sense the way you want it? To a degree. I know if you're 4 feet three, you can't look like Charles Atlas. But you can proportionately. But through proper diet and exercise, you as a youth can build a future. Because you cannot hold a good job with bad health. You cannot study with a phlegmatic mind. And if you're fat and frustrated, you will not get that handsome Lochinvar you wanted. And vice versa as a young man. You want to meet and marry a beautiful young woman? Now don't tell me you don't. I say you're lying if you don't say you don't. Where are you going to find her? Like attracts like. You want to meet and marry a beautiful young woman? Then you make yourself into a handsome, strong young man. You can. But if you hate the Sabbath and seethe over it, you'll waste your chance. And you may miss Miss Beautiful, too. You want a handsome young man? As a woman, as a youth, as a young girl, I hope you find him. I really do. It really fills me with joy to see young people in the church, married and happy, content with each other. That's a good solid foundation and a fabulous beginning. But it doesn't just happen automatically. You as a youth have a part in it also. They say that beauty is only skin deep. But ugliness goes clear to the bone. Okay. That's my joke for the day. There was a young fellow in the high school that I went to, a small country school in West Texas, when he was in the eighth grade, Jim Reeves decided to become the state champion of Texas in the Class B mile run. Well, that was stupid. he was just a little guy. And the thought of a freshman, as he would be next year in high school, winning the Texas State B class, the Class B State Mile Run was kind of silly. But he began to lift weights, he began to run, he watched his diet, he got out the fried foods, he stopped dating, he didn't need to be in eighth grade, but he was. He went to bed at 9:30 every night, he got up, he forced himself to exercise, he forced himself to sleep, he forced himself to watch his diet. And Jimmy won the district mile run, he won the regional mile run. He went to the University of Texas in Austin in a big stadium, and he showed the seniors a clean pair of heels in the mile run because he was in fantastically good health as a youth in the ninth grade. He did that again as a sophomore, and he lowered the record. He did it again as a junior, and he lowered the record. But he got a little cocky. In his senior year, he got married, and he came in second. That proves one thing. Those women will do it to you every time. As far as they say, marriage is weakening, but who wants to be strong? But he was a year behind me. I don't know what happened. I think he got a scholarship to go to Abilene Christian, ACC in Abilene, which was at Bobby Morrow back in the 52, or it was at the name of the 48, whatever it was, world-class champion. There was another, was a young lady in my class. Joanne Winchester lived in a wealthy home. She was far above us in the farming community. But Joanne was fat, to say the least. She was wealthy. I hope she's not here today. Because the last I heard, she was living in Caracas, Venezuela. But for 8 years, Joanne was wealthy and fat. I don't know what clicked in Joanne's mind in the summer of 1951, but wow, the change. She became a beautiful young woman. And she became the FFA sweetheart of the state of Texas that year. And of course, the FFA president, John Hager, made it a point to come around to visit our little town. And he went to Texas A&M, and she later married him. I think, I don't know what's ever happened, but the point is, Joanne saw the light with exercise, with diet. She changed her whole image. Completed high school in 3 years, and went to Harvey Simmons and finished in 3 years. And she really rearranged her life. Money was not everything. Something had to click in Joanne's mind. Apparently it did. Now you're probably listening saying, yeah, but that doesn't make a difference. God looks on the heart, physical beauty, that's not worth anything at all. We want to emphasize the spiritual because God doesn't look on the outside, He looks on the heart. That's true, there is a place in the Bible that emphasizes that, and I want you to look at what it says in the context in which it says it, and what happens right after it is said, youth. In 1 Samuel 16, the story of the young lad David, son of Jesse. David's been Jesse. 1 Samuel 16, beginning in verse 1. Saul had disqualified himself, but he hadn't been removed, and Samuel was grieving over it. God said to Samuel, how long are you going to mourn over Saul? Don't you know I rejected him from ruling over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I'll send you to Jesse, where I have provided thee a king among his sons. Skipping down to verse 5, Samuel wouldn't know how to get there, so Saul was causing trouble, and he said, well, take a young heifer with you and say you will go to sacrifice. And of course, when the prophet came down, they were all uneasy. They wanted to know why he came. He said, peace. In the latter part of verse 5, he set upon Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. Now when they were come, Samuel looked on Eli, and he said, surely The Lord has anointed him before him. Apparently he was tall, strong, olive skinned, handsome specimen of manhood. God said to Samuel, "Don't look on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him." God doesn't see as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks inside. He looks on the heart. And I always fear sometimes when we emphasize that there is a yawning chasm between the heart, righteousness, means of the body, and the sour complexion, agony filled, sunken chest, no personality in a deep, lifeless individual, a worn out hunk of junk. You gotta be before God calls you and uses you. If you're strong and well built and good looking and got something on the ball, then you're going to be rejected because of that, because God doesn't want that. That's vanity. And he said, "Don't look on the outside. I look inside, I look on the heart." Well, let's keep reading. In verse 8, Jesse called him to death. He said, "No, not him." He made Shiloh pass by. He said, "Not that one either." Jesse had 7 sons. And Samuel said, "No, none of these." Well, Samuel said to Jesse, "Is that all you got?" We looked at him, there wasn't any here. There must be something else. Well, he said, "The other is one more, but he's out keeping the sheep." Samuel said, "Go get him. We're not going to sit down until we take an eyeball look at him." So he brought him in. And he was flat-chested, spindly legged, psyched out, very self-conscious, acne all over his face, couldn't put 2 words together, didn't make any sense, was so self-conscious he just backed right out of the room. But he had a good heart. David ben Jesse walked in the room, the one on whom God looked at his heart. You look at this. David was ruddy and of a beautiful countenance. He was a good-looking kid, sharp, intelligent, cocky, confident. We would have called him the smart-aleck, snot-nosed kid today. Beautiful countenance, goodly to look to. It is a pleasant thing to see a handsome, well-built young man, a beautiful, svelte-figured young girl. That is not evil. And Jesus didn't say it's a sin to look on them, to admire beauty. He said it's wrong to look at lust. He was of a beautiful countenance, goodly to look to, and God said, "Arise, anoint him. This is the one." Good-looking, well-built, personal. He was going to be king of Israel. Now, how come David was this way? Had he hated his father's Sabbath, holy days, and all that? Wouldn't appear so, or it wouldn't appear that he wasted his chances. Coming to verse 16, it also shows that Saul was in need, because of his bad attitude and the demons bothering him, of some music to soothe the beast in him. And they chose someone, and they chose David. Saul, in verse 17, said, "Provide a man who can play well and bring him to me." And they said, "Well, I've seen the son of Jesse, that is cunning and playing, mighty valiant, and a man of war prudent in matters, and a comely person. Good-looking, musically talented, socially gracious. You can be that and still be a shepherd. A shepherd doesn't mean you're run over at the heels of a hick, socially embarrassed, dumb and stupid, and totally out of it. Not at all." In verse 19, it shows, he said, "Send me David, your son, to Jesse." Jesse took an ass, laid it with bread, a bottle of wine, and kid, and sent it by David. David came to Saul and stood before him. He was able to stand in the presence of the king, and he knew what to do. He didn't back out because he was so embarrassed. He said, "Let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." There's a little bit more to this physical condition and God looking on the heart in chapter 17, verse 12. David was not a worn-out, spent youth. In verse 12, David was the son of Ephrathite of Bethlehem. Well, this is talking about the challenging of Goliath, challenging of the Israelite army. And David was a baby, and he went to the war camp to see what was going on. His father sent him there. And verse 14, David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul. They went to war. But David went and returned from Saul to feed the father's sheep. Now you may hear the little skinny kid that is afraid, who has no personality, no muscles. And you read about Goliath challenging every day for 40 days. And in verse 20, David rose up in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper. So you know that David had knowledge of stock, animals. There's a certain common sense and sanity that comes to you by working in and among animals. A certain presence of mind and a certain confidence toward life also, if you're talented and able to work with stock. And let's see. David asked what was going on and why nobody was challenging him. And in verse 20, the men of Israel fled from before Goliath, and they were all shook up. And let's see, down in verse 26, David spoke to the man and said, "What shall be done if man kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach?" And they said, "Well, he'll be given Saul's daughter to marriage." Well, there was this cocky young kid who only had a good heart before God, and he had the audacity to take up the challenge. Now, if you're sick, weak will, spindly leg, full of acne, and worn out, I don't think you're going to take up the challenge. Here was the young kid who had the muscles and the stupidity, in one sense, from a human viewpoint, the audacity to try to do it. And he believed he could do it. He not only had the right attitude before God, the God of his father, but he also had the muscle power to do it. Physically, looking at it from a human viewpoint. Verse 32, David, the youth, said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of it. Your servant will go and fight." David was told by Saul, "You're not able to go. You're just a youth." Now, I don't know how old he was, maybe 20, 22, 23. That's looking younger all the time to me. And look at this. David said to Saul, when he was said, "Well, you're just a kid, you can't do anything," he said, "Your servant kept his father's sheep. There came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I ran the other way because I was scared to death." Now, you know, as a youth, if your father's flock is attacked by a lion or a bear, you better have a little bit on the ball in the body to challenge that lion. Either that or just be so stupid you don't know what to do. He said in verse 35, "I went after him." Now that takes a little knowledge that you're able to do it. Now you don't think you're going to do it unless you're built well enough to think you can do it. "I caught him by the beard, I smote him, and I slew him. The servant slew both the lion and the bear." This Philistine is going to be the same way. "God delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the bear, and he'll deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine." David was good looking, well built, and he didn't have a rotten attitude towards the truth. He had not wasted his chances physically. He had taken advantage of his opportunities to develop himself in a physical way. And because of that, partly he had the right attitude. He had a good heart toward God. How important is the physical aspect of life? Mr. Herbert Armstrong talks about the fact that he died because he pushed his body beyond its limits. And he, the apostle of God's church, had to rebuild his health. Yes, God blessed him, but Mr. Armstrong had to do his part. Physical life is very important. It's important for the future. It is difficult to remain converted if you're in pain all the time. It is difficult to pray and study if you're in agony physically. I returned to Indianapolis this past week to perform a funeral. A 76-year-old lady, her body was disintegrating. She was bedfast for years. Both hip joints came apart. Her spine is disintegrating. She's better off dead. Now she's got it made. She died in faith, and she has achieved the most important, but she suffered in life because of physical health, bad physical health. Life is physical. In Proverbs 31, verse 30, it said, beauty is vain. No, it doesn't say that. You look, is in italics. Beauty can be the vanity, yes. If it does, that's your problem. But beauty is not of itself vanity. Physical health is not of itself vanity. It can engender vanity, but if it does, that's because you're not controlling it. But is ugliness and bad health righteousness? No, it isn't. Ugliness and bad health is not righteousness and will not lead to a good life. I said to you, if you want a good-looking husband, make yourself into a good-looking youth, a woman. If you want a good-looking wife, make yourself into a good-looking boy. But if you hate the Sabbath and you waste your chances, you may never get it. This is the Pepsi generation. This is the era of the junk food junkie. We laugh at it. Coke doesn't add lies. It adds cavities. It's a hypoglycemia. Just because you have read and believed the doctrine of unclean foods does not mean you'll automatically have good health. It takes knowledge and it takes exercise. And you can, to a degree, as a youth, sculpture yourself and help mold your future. God will help you. In being involved in YLU in the Great Lakes region, I went to Pasadena with the track team this last summer. After the meet was over, we sat in the bus getting ready to load onto the plane at the Los Angeles International Airport. I said to the team, I think you can see that YLU is a wonderful opportunity. And I think you can see, those of you who have been here, that with just a little bit of effort, there has been a wonderful return for you who are here. Some have never been to Pasadena, never seen the campus, never been in the auditorium, they've never flown on a jet plane before. They exercised, they pushed themselves, and there was a tremendous blessing and reward for them who did it. I'm sorry that all the youth in the church couldn't be there, but that's life, youth. Not everybody gets the same chances because not everybody does the same thing. So, take care of yourself. That's a very important point in life. Very, very important. Another really important aspect of life is sex and marriage. God promised to ancient Israel that they would be the leaders of the world if they followed His laws. In Exodus 20, he gave the Ten Commandments, the basis of his law, the basis of his style of life, of his life's culture. Exodus 21, 22, and 23 give the statutes, the civil laws that regulated a nation, a city, or a group of people that would ensure they would be the leaders of all the world. You look at the very first one. It's kind of subtle in its first appearance because it talks about slavery. but it's talking about far more. And it affects you today in God's church. Exodus 21, verse 6, naturally after giving the Ten Commandments, the most important, and after the latter part of chapter 20, talking about not committing idolatry, building high places for idolatrous worship, he gets into chapter 21 and verse 1, he said, these are the judgments, your statutes that you have set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, God's way included slavery. It was talking about owning your own countrymen. It was not talking about owning the nations around them. It was talking about owning their own people. We recoil at the thought of that. But there are a lot of people today living in abject slavery in the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And they live in more slavery than this because this only lasted at the outside 6 years. And hopefully they learned the lesson. If you buy a Hebrew slave, 6 years he will serve you, and the seventh year he will go out free. It was not perpetual slavery. It's a lot better to be a slave to a successful man than to be on your own and live in poverty. There are a lot of poverty-stricken people today because they made the mistake. God said, here, don't make. The very first law he gave to ensure they'd be the leaders. Yes, it dealt with slavery, but there was something underneath. If he came in by himself, he'll go out by himself. If he was married, then his wife goes out with him. If his master gave him a wife, and he's born, and she has born him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her masters, and he'll go out by himself. Now, we think that is awful. What a horrible thing. Yet that man knew that. What is the quickest way to ruin your life? An ill-advised, untimed marriage involving kids that are an imposition on your life. You are then in slavery the rest of your life. And there are a lot of people around you today that can say amen, amen, amen to that. And I don't say that maliciously. You know, I'm the eighth of nine children. When I was born, they just added a little more water to the gravy. There are a lot of things I didn't have because it just wasn't there to give. And God has blessed me fantastically in His work. And I have vicariously now what I never had before. But I didn't get it. It was given. The man would know that. Now, in one sense, the man was between a rock and a hard spot. He was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. If he couldn't wait in slavery, he went ahead and got married because he couldn't wait. His path was already fixed. When he went out, he had a choice. But he really didn't have a choice. He could have his freedom, but not his wife and kids. Or he could have his wife and kids, but not his freedom. What an awful decision to make. But he had to make that. He was forced into that configuration because somewhere way back down the road, he made a wrong choice and he wouldn't and didn't and couldn't wait. He had to have sex now. You know, once the first flush of sex is over, there's not much to buy. If you don't have money for underwear and food and clothes and rent and insurance and an automobile and all the other things, sex is putrid. And there are a lot of marriages that are breaking up because sex won't hold them. It won't. I know I can't convince the youth that sex is not the most important thing in life. But it isn't. It's a fantastically wonderful part of life. But it's not the most important. Now, the man had to make a choice. I would hate to have had to make that choice. In Proverbs 24 and verse 27, it says, prepare yourself in the field first. After you build your house. What it says is, prepare yourself for life and then get yourself sex. That's what it says. Prepare and make yourself ready in an occupation first, and then look around and get ready to be married. Marriage can be wonderful if you are successful in life already, and you're headed down the road toward success, and you take unto yourself a mate and companion with whom you share life, not just sex. How do you destroy youth? Pollute them sexually. Sex is wonderful. Sex is beautiful. It is unbelievable how wonderful sex can be. As I give to youth in Indianapolis, there are reasons other than prayer and Bible study that I smile a lot. God is not trying to withhold sex from you. In Proverbs 5, he says that. He is not trying to withhold sex from you. He's trying to get you to prepare for sex properly. And he has the right and a wonderful outlet for sexual energies. Proverbs 5, beginning in verse 16, he said, drink waters out of your own cistern. Pardon the analogy, ladies, but there's a brother and a sister, and you are the sister. A never-ending supply of wonderful good things. Running waters out of your own well. Does that sound like God is trying to withhold sex from people? Not at all. Let your fountains be dispersed and rivers of water in the streets. Let them be your own and not strangers. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her be as the loving hind in the pleasant grove, and let her breast satisfy you at all times. And be thou ravished always with her love. The ravished means intoxicated. Don't get a fifth of white light and then go off with your hound dog hunting and get drunk. Go home and get drunk. But your wife. Well, not whip your wife drunk, but you know what I mean, don't you? Be thou intoxicated with your wife. Do you ever just drink in deeply of the love and affection of your wife? Second to God's truth and God's spirit, I count my lovely wife as one of the most fantastic blessings that ever has ever come along in my life. And I know that as a spiritual man of God, who I don't have my collar on backwards, but I suppose you look at us as spiritual men of God, I have what you're looking for. Good health, a beautiful, converted, good woman, sexually attractive, converted, and a wonderful companion in life who has given me two lovely sons. I have a good job. I have a good life. Now, you want to leave the church and get those, don't you? I ask you, where are you going to go get them? I have them, but I didn't get them. They were given because I tried to conform my life to God's ways. Like I said, there are reasons I smile a lot. And I enjoy it. It's very cool. I have to pinch myself sometimes to believe that this is religion. This is religion. Not what I originally knew religion was. I hope that you all enjoy it as you. But if you think sex is free and easy now and get pregnant, louse up your life, and they have four-letter expressions for that that you're well acquainted with, I think it's appropriate. Go ahead. But you will cry the rest of your life. And it'll be your fault that you cheated yourself because you hated God's law. It is there for the taking and asking. My wife grew up in the church from age 12. She grew up in the church when the sermons were 3 hours long from the dictionary. She grew up when there was no Y-O-U. She grew up when there were a few social occasions, and the old men were the only ones to dance with. She has cried herself to sleep many nights because the future didn't look like it held much. But she had a mother who prayed for her, and I'm sure fasted for her, and tried to push her in the right direction. And Lee tried to go in the right direction. She tried to do what was right, and I kid her sometimes and tease her that God has blessed her fantastically beyond her wildest expectations. He let her marry me. In 1954, entered into the senior year of high school, I visited my sister in Fort Lavaca, Texas, South Texas. I live in Northwest. I met a young Catholic girl, sophomore in high school. Her curls had fancied me, too. Bernice was a beautiful young lady, Catholic. I was Baptist. I went home. We wrote. As we say, I slipped my lid, my cookie. But I heard a Catholic priest one day talking on the radio, and he said, if we didn't have so many mixed marriages, we wouldn't have so many troubles with the Catholic Church. By mixed, he didn't mean interracial, he meant interfaith, Catholic, Protestant. I said, you know, the guy's right. So I wrote a letter to Bernice, and I said, we're 600 miles apart. We may never get married. You're Catholic, I'm Baptist. I think we ought to just cool it, you know? Well, of course, that's the classic brush-off when you got somebody else on the line. But I didn't have. I'm sure Bernice is a wonderful woman. But she was Catholic and I was Protestant, and that wouldn't have done it in those days. Those Baptists cussed the Catholics on Sunday morning in those days. I have a wonderful marriage because, now I'm not perfect, I'm just telling you the good points, because I did try to follow the directions. And I smile a lot these days. In his book, Men at the Top, the author had one chapter on up from something. You hear these stories of guys who came up from nothing. That's not true. There was a foundational stepping stone from which they sprang to become something. Maybe they had a minister father and teacher father. There was something that gave them a leap forward. You, the Church of God, and the parents of the Church of God are your stepping stones. You have something to step from to become something. Not nothing. But there's one thing we need, and that's your consent. We can't do anything without your consent. YOU is not going to be your salvation. It is only an outlet for those who've already prepared your heart and want to participate in it. But YOU will not do a thing for you. It will not save you. It will not give you a future. It is only an outlet for those who want to participate in it. And I said to those in Los Angeles, you can see that with a little bit of effort, there is a fantastic reward that has come to you. The future will be here tomorrow. You're going to be in it. What niche you hold in it is the variable. That depends on you and you. I hope, like Millard Fillmore, you're preparing today to ensure that you have a better future tomorrow, because there will be a tomorrow. And I hope, youth of God's church, that you will be there and your future will be a full, rich, abundantly bountiful, wonderful future.
Thank you for listening to this audio file from the Worldwide Church of God Library Collection. Please visit wwcg-library.com and explore the incredible truths that answer the mysteries of life.